Welcome to The Leader's Edge, where we celebrate leadership and shine a light on the visionary leaders shaping the future. Hey, I'm H.R. Huntsman, founder of Leader's Edge, creator of the Leader's Edge Performance Engine and Leader's Edge University. I am thrilled to bring you stories from leaders who are making a difference around the world. In each and every episode, we champion the innovative strategies, courageous decisions, and inspiring journeys of those who lead with purpose and passion. So whether you're looking to refine your leadership skills or you simply want to be inspired, you are in the right place. I can't wait for you to meet this next guest. Today, we're joined by an innovator at the intersection of engineering and AI, Mohamed Al-Arnout. Mohamed is the CEO and co-founder of DraftAid, the company behind the world's first generative AI platform built specifically for mechanical engineering. DraftAid's story started when Mohamed and his partners combined their expertise in engineering and AI to solve one of the industry's biggest frustrations, the tedious drawing process. With a degree in mechatronics engineering from the University of Waterloo and a career that spanned roles from software engineer to startup leader, Mohamed brings both technical depth and entrepreneurial vision to the table. Beyond DraftAid, he's someone who loves the outdoors, loves to hike, fish, backyard barbecue with the family and friends. We're excited to hear Mohamed's story, the vision behind DraftAid, and his perspective on how AI is transforming the future of engineering. So let's gain some insight on how to scale a startup from Mohamed Al-Arnout. Mohamed, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I really appreciate your time, my friend.
Thank you, HR.
All right, first question. What has failure taught you?
Ooh, failure is a friend. Failure is a good friend.
Nice.
You shouldn't be afraid to fail. It's probably been the best friend, honestly. So I started a company before my current company, DraftAid. We ran that company for 6 months, and I think it was probably the best 6 months of my life. I learned the most number of lessons there. We can go into it, but...
I do. I want to hear what you learned from failure.
So we started a company building AI for architects. We were specifically solving the problem of doing code checks for architects. What we realized is we're building this tech that was a really cool tech. I'm an engineer. I'm a software engineer by heart. And so I wanted to build cool tech. We were building the coolest of tech. But then when we took this tech to the industry, when we went to architects and we showed it to them, their response was very lukewarm. We had spent a long time building this fantastic technology, only then to find out this is a lukewarm response from folks who maybe a few months ago were super excited. They loved the idea, but then when we showed it to them, they said, I'm just not willing to pay. Or maybe I'm not willing to pay enough. And so it was a very hard lesson in the fact that you want to solve a problem that's a hair on fire problem. A problem that's, your solution should be a must-have for your customer. It should not be a nice-to-have.
It's a great differentiator.
Absolutely.
So a must-have versus a nice-to-have.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. Okay. Oh, yeah. Keep going with that taught you. So it taught you the difference between a must-have and a nice-to-have.
I think it definitely taught me the, when you talk to customers and they tell you, hey, yeah, I love this. I want to buy it. People say, I love this and I want to buy it all the time. People are nice. No one wants to be mean. But then when you put the contract on the table, that's the real test.
Okay.
And so I learned early on that if you want to validate an idea, make sure there's a signed contract. Make sure this person really wants to buy.
Yeah.
If they do sign the contract, and again, doesn't need to be, when you're validating an idea early on, doesn't need to be a large value. It doesn't need to be anything too crazy, but you really want to put it to the test. There's a sales book, I forget what it's called. And I remember it had this saying, and it's not a very nice saying, but it says, buyers are liars. And the idea was, people are nice, they don't want to be mean.
Right.
They'll tell you, I want to buy. And so I think me coming from a technical background, I didn't have this knowledge. And so I had to learn it the hard way.
Very good. Where did this entrepreneurial bug come from?
Oh,
I love entrepreneurs. I'm a serial entrepreneur by heart, started several companies.
Yes.
I love people who jump off the cliff from employee to entrepreneur. Tell me about that. Where did it come from? Then we're going to talk about the actual jump.
Oh, buddy. I think like from an early age, like I still remember, I think it was grade 7 or grade 8. I grew up in a family that was very STEM-based, a very scientific family. And I remember growing up and thinking, this isn't what I want to do. I want to do something else. And I remember my dad had this friend who was running a large holding company. They just owned a whole bunch of companies. I said, hey, I want to do what that guy does. And I remember I'd see this guy and he goes to all these different businesses. He operates all these businesses. He had a lot of different skills. And I said, I want to see what it means to be that guy. So I asked my dad, hey, can I do an internship with this guy? And so he owned a couple of companies. His first company was a t-shirt sales or like tourist I Heart New York type stuff. Yeah. At the time we were in Dubai, and so he had this I Heart Dubai company. And so I remember I worked in the Dubai heat, 50 degrees Celsius. I don't know what that is, maybe 100 Fahrenheit or something.
100 plus, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I was outside in summer during my summer break selling t-shirts to tourists.
Oh my goodness.
And I still remember it was one of the scariest things I ever did. You just approach people and you're like, hey, would you like to buy a shirt?
Yeah, yeah.
But then right then and there, I remember my first sale. I saw the shirt for, it was 50 dirhams. I still remember, which is like, I don't know, like $15 or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this is the best money I ever made.
Dopamine rush goes
off.
Oh
my God. And that, honestly, I think I caught a sales bug. I caught a sales bug at that point, but then they promoted me. And the guy who was running the company, he really wanted to give me this like experience. So he said he owned a used car dealership. And he said, hey, you go and try to sell cars now.
Oh my gosh.
And that was exhilarating. Unfortunately, and this is where failure comes back, I was not very good at selling cars. It turns out people don't want to buy a car from a person who looks 8 years old, grade eight. And I didn't sell a single car, but I ended up working in the operations. So I helped in like the paperwork and a lot of that stuff. And I realized there's more to a business than just sales, there's marketing, there's back office management. I still remember it was grade eight, end of that summer, I said, I'm going to do entrepreneurship. I want to do a business, and that's my calling.
Okay. So what was the first one? Was it the one that you failed at, or was there something before that?
I did actually try a business during university. I was really in a rush. So I went into mechatronics engineering. I decided to go into it because I thought, you know what, I want to get some skills, some actual engineering STEM skills.
Yeah, sure.
But I want something general. And so I went into mechatronics. I did mechanical, electrical, software, the whole deal. And then I started a company where we were doing like geolocating within stores. So like if you go to a Costco,
sure,
you open up your map and it shows you where the milk is and you can just like Google Maps it,
so
to speak.
Yeah.
Another failure. I told you, failure is good friend.
Oh, it's the best teacher.
It's a good friend. And so it was a failure for various reasons. Chief amongst them is it turns out doing a business and university at the same time is not the best idea.
It's tough.
It's very difficult. I went to Waterloo, which was also an internship university where you have to do 2 years of compulsory industry work to graduate.
Oh, wow.
And I worked all the way from Ottawa to Sunnyvale, California. And a whole bunch of companies in between during that time period. But yeah, starting a company was very hard. I think there's definitely, the learning I had there is, there's a level of skill, a base level of skill that you definitely need to have. And then also, you also need a network. Like starting a company, starting a business, your first champions are your friends and family, right, your network.
That's right.
By the end of university, you should have a big network and at least some skill set.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, let's jump to Draft Aid.
Okay.
Current company started not quite 2 years ago.
Yep.
What's the brainstorm behind it? And then I really want to explore how you go from entrepreneur to team builder. Tell me the birth first.
Okay, I was camping in Algonquin, and I was driving back, and my buddy calls me, and he says, hey, I met this guy. He's a mechanical engineer. And he's telling me about this, like, AI for mechanical engineering he's thinking about. Do you want to chat with him? And I said, sure. And I remember I was on the way from like up north in Canada, like 4 hours north of Toronto. And on my way back, we stop at a Tim Hortons, like it's the most Canadian founding story ever. And so we stop at this Tim Hortons and I meet my co-founder, my current business partner. And he tells me, hey, I sit in an office with 40 people making drawings of 3D models. And you're telling me there's ChatGPT that can write emails and write code and do all that. But I still have to like make drawings?
Architectural drawings.
Mechanical drawings, like schematics. Drawings.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah.
And I said, hey, like what you just described isn't a simple ask. It's a big ask. And that ask needs a company, right? It takes many people, a lot of time. There's R&D involved.
Okay.
And right then and there, we said, hey, let's explore it. Let's think about this. Let's explore it. And so we started the exploration about 2.5 years ago. We said, hey, let's just look at the industry. Let's look at the market. I took my learnings from multiple failures.
Sure.
where I said, hey, first things first, we need to prove, is this a hair on fire problem? Are we building a must-have or a nice-to-have?
We're good.
And we did the legwork. We spoke to so many mechanical engineers. I just sat there on days just cold calling mechanical engineers and just saying, hey, I'm not selling anything. I just want to know, is this a problem that bothers you? And I was familiar with this problem, but from university, I did mechanical engineering. But I didn't want to fall into that pit hole again where I build a product that's really expensive and difficult to build, only to find that it's a nice to have.
That's nice.
It's nifty.
That's cool.
Yeah. And so we spent actually majority of our early days were just that. We didn't even work on the tech. We didn't do any of that. We just, is this something people really want? And
good.
It wasn't hard to prove people. The reception was absolutely insane.
Okay.
When you have a must have, when you have a hair on fire problem, you will know it. You will know it. And we knew it. We had folks who wanted to sign contracts with us. And we'd show them this demo. And they'd want to sign a contract with us. And we'd say, hey, sorry, like it's a bit too early.
We don't have the...
This is just a demo. We're just proving an idea.
Okay.
And so once that went through, I said, hey, we got to do this now.
Okay.
That was the leap of faith.
All right.
That was the, I'm going to quit my job and start a company. No income. No, I didn't have really much of a backup plan. It was an all or nothing type of thing. And but that entrepreneurial bug, honestly, it drives you.
Yeah.
It's like, it just calls to you. And so...
That's a great way to describe it.
It really does. It was... I still remember going into the meeting with my VP. At the time, I was the director of engineering at a startup. And then I went to the VP and I said, hey, I'm going to quit. And I still remember to the last second, I was like, what am I doing? This is crazy. Yeah. Didn't we do this before?
Right.
Did you not learn your lesson?
Right.
And even though going into it, the days leading up to that meeting, I was very confident.
Yeah.
But in the minute, I was pretty scared and I said, just do it.
Did you have funding? Is this self-funded?
Self-funded.
So you had no PE or VC or nothing?
Nope, nothing.
This is you.
Me and I had two partners and that's it. And
you're bankrolling it yourself.
100%.
Okay. So let's clarify what it actually does. Mm-hmm. And then I want to get into the leadership side. So as I understand it, you take a 3D model of some object and AI, what is it, scan it?
So
how does it turn from 3D into a 2D mechanical drawing?
Absolutely. So it's now quite a bit more than just that. But when we first started, the problem we were solving is mechanical engineers spend about 20 to 40% of their time turning a 3D design in CAD, it could be SolidWorks or Autodesk Inventor or Siemens, into a 2D schematic drawing that describes that 3D model. This drawing is then sent to the manufacturer and informs the manufacturer how to manufacture this part.
Okay.
But if you think about it, that's 20 to 40% of an engineer's time is spent in essentially repeating what they've already done because they've already made a 3D design.
They made a 3D, right?
And so when we started DraftAid, our mission was very simple. DraftAid is going to be an AI that automates this tedious process of turning 3D designs into 2D drawings.
So you're saving me time.
Exactly.
Okay.
Saving you time, removing mistakes. There's always mistakes. It's human error is involved.
Okay.
Standardization is a very big one. Drawings are an art sometimes. And so people usually add their own flair. But then if you're talking to a company like Toyota or another, all these automotive companies, they want standardization.
Sure, of course.
And so we end up being actually a very strong standardization tool. This was the vision when we started. We were the first AI tool for mechanical engineers on the market.
Is that right?
We were the first. And in fact, you asked me about VCs. 1 month after I left my job, and we launched our product and we were tinkering, we got accepted into the biggest VC in the world, Y Combinator, literally a month later. And this is where I tell people, when you have a must-have, when you have a hair on fire problem, things are so easy.
Money will flow.
Because you found a problem that people really want. You're making something people want.
Sure, okay. So we got to talk about the leap that I care about. That's a leap from inventor, entrepreneur, engineer, to developing a team. Entirely different skill set. Talk to me about that leap, that learning curve.
That was, in all honesty, that was one that really snuck up on me. When you first start, especially if you're technical, I started by focusing on the engineering, the software, the product. Then when we build out our sales and we build out our sales team, I focused a lot on that. And then now the company, within a year and a half, we're now at about 11 people.
Yeah.
And now it's no longer really going to the micro. There is macro that you need to focus on. And I remember watching this video for Steve Jobs a long time ago. at a Stanford lecture where someone asked him, like, how do you prioritize? There's so much you got to do. And he said, hey, you can focus on the micro problems of particular product issues, particular small minute issues within the company, or you can focus on the macro. And for him, he said the macro was hire great people and set a great vision, and all the micro problems solve themselves.
Okay.
And honestly, that was the only thing I knew about leadership to start. And I thought, hey, you know what? This is a good start. Let's start here. And so we started by just making sure we hire slow. We take our time to hire.
Okay.
Over, I think, the last year and a half, we really didn't hire fast. It might seem like we hired a lot, but we didn't.
You're growing quickly.
We're growing quickly.
Sure.
But every single time we always say we want to be overutilized in our capacity rather than have multiple team members when we don't need them. And so we take about months interviewing. We make sure that the folks we interview, they love this industry. They're really interested for this industry.
Okay.
Usually, when we first started, actually, it was very interesting. We said, hey, mechanical engineering is hard to teach someone, so let's hire mechanical engineers who know software. Turns out there aren't a lot of mechanical engineers who know software.
Okay.
And so we said, okay, now what we should do is let's hire great software engineers, and then we need to become great mechanical engineering professors. And so whenever we hire a software engineer or even folks in our sales or marketing team, within the first month, our main mission is, how can I teach you mechanical engineering?
Okay.
How can I teach you manufacturing? Such that within a month, 2-3 months, you should know as much as a first year or second year university student about manufacturing. We play this little game in the company where we walk around and we'll point at something. Like, for example, a window or like a gate or something or a door, and we'll say, hey, how is that manufactured? And then whoever the most recent hire needs to say, oh, that's an extruded little extrusion. It's cut at an angle. It's then welded to this other part. And they have to describe all
of that. They have to understand
that. They have to understand
that.
And so we really wanted to have this culture of loving manufacturing, loving this industry, because we need to know what our customers want. Otherwise, you're not solving a hair on fire problem.
Let's talk about that intersection. I'm fascinated always by the intersection of culture and skills in each person. So how much time do you spend? So we could hire a highly skilled technical person who's a toxic, backstabbing, late, all kinds of toxic team stuff. Or we could hire an amazing team person who doesn't know crap about mechanical or software engineering. How do you wed the two or meld the two together? Understand the culture at Draft Aid. You got to believe what we believe and dream like we dream, but you have to be really good at what you do. How do you make sure that happens?
So we created this interview system. It took a while to figure it out.
Okay, good. This is great.
And actually at the time, I even went to Y Combinator and a whole bunch of people I knew, and I said, hey, how do you interview? And so the first thing you usually check for is, does this person have the right technical credentials?
Okay.
They have to have. We do not compromise on technical capability. It's a startup. We move really fast. When we started, we had one product. Today, we have actually three products.
Is that right?
Three products. One of them, like one that is deployed across hundreds of engineers at this point within just one organization, let alone all the different organizations. Our customers are all the way from Australia to the West Coast.
Of America.
And not over the Pacific.
Go the other way.
Yeah, go the other way.
That's a short trip there.
And so we take meetings from 5 a.m. till 8 p.m.
Okay.
And so we never compromise on talent or technical skill. But our interviews are usually two-parters. The second part is we want to make sure the person we're interviewing also cares about this industry. They care about the environment we're in. Understand startups. That's something that we usually, in our one of our requirements is, you have to have previous startup experience.
Okay.
Startups are hard. You don't have systems around you.
Right.
If you work at Amazon or a big company, you have another team who will, the guy who boils the water and the guy who like dips the tea bag in the hot water are different people.
Totally different people.
Over here, no, you do everything. All our engineers meet with customers. So we actually follow what's known as a forward deployed engineer.
Okay.
And the idea is that every engineer
makes sense.
Is also a customer success person with the customer.
Wow.
And so our problem is even harder because we need to hire folks that can speak to customers.
Good emotional intelligence, good communication.
100%.
Can't be just a traditional engineer.
And so we don't compromise on both of those things.
Okay.
I'd say we've been blessed that we haven't had any toxic team members so far.
Good.
Maybe as the company grows, that will happen. I'm sure it will happen, and I'll have to grow as a leader to figure out how to deal with that.
Sure. So that makes me curious, as a leader of companies, the way you're shaped now, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't feel scalable at large size. So have you already thought about how to scale and be a little bit more, you're shaking your head, yeah, yes. You've given this some thought. That's not going to work at scale.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So this was another learning from failures. There's a rule in startups, which is when you start a small company, do things that don't scale. And the reason that advice is there, and it's a very common kind of advice for startups, is because don't do what Google does, flying at a million miles up there. Do what Google did when they first started, when
sure.
they were three people.
Of course.
We've been quite blessed so far that we haven't had to scale, but we're reaching that pivotal moment.
You're getting close.
And we just now recently hired a chief of staff to help scale
okay.
more of that operations,
okay.
the back office operations. I still remember, like, up till just a few months ago, I used to do all the receipt management. I do payroll. I do, along with all the other things
sure.
that I have to do.
When we started, we do. That's right.
100%.
All right? That's got to scale.
100%.
I can't be on your desk
exactly.
very soon.
I think around June, I realized I was doing like 5 full-time jobs.
Right.
And I was doing maybe 16-hour days. And I
yeah.
said, and even my health was taking a bit
sure.
of a hit.
Yeah, it's not scalable. Yeah.
And I said, hey, I think we've hit that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we have now a chief of
good.
Staff.
Okay,
we have we hired more salespeople.
Okay.
I no longer can do, me and my partner, we used to do the sales calls. It's just not possible anymore.
Right.
From 6 a.m. to 8 p.m.
Okay, good.
Right?
So you're learning this, yeah.
We are hiring across multiple time zones.
Yeah.
Makes life easier.
I'm sure you're going to write SOPs, got it coming up. You're going to have to write scripting.
100%.
For sales teams, yeah.
100%. Right. I had to take all my sales knowledge and transfer it.
For sure.
We even had to establish, part of scaling a company is you have to establish some policies.
Of course.
It's no longer the Wild West.
No.
And we had to establish some policies. There's
employee
a lot of software.
Handbooks. Yeah,
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
100%. It's the part of starting a company that no one tells you about.
It's the real stuff.
It's the real...
It's the nuts and bolts of how you actually build a company.
The other thing, and I think you touched upon it, and it's something that also snuck up on me, is when we were 5 people or 4 people in a room, it was very easy for me to communicate my vision on
That's
daily
right.
basis.
That's right.
Because I'm interacting with every single person
yeah.
on daily basis.
Yeah.
Today, I don't interact with everyone on daily basis.
Yeah.
In fact, I've been traveling for the last 2 weeks. I haven't been in the office for a while.
Right.
And so I realized the importance of setting a very clear vision, a very well-communicated vision. And it took me a while to perfect that. Like, I tried to do it, I remember Q1 of this year, I did a big presentation, and I think it set a good vision, but it wasn't clear enough.
Yeah.
Then in Q2, I got a lot clearer.
Okay.
I think this quarter, beginning of this quarter, I set a vision for the next few months. And I think this has probably been my clearest and most concise.
Perfect.
Takes time.
Yeah. I always say that founders, CEOs have to leak vision everywhere.
100%.
Like, it's just part of your deal now. You 100%. Have to be a vision caster.
You have to repeat it every day.
All the time.
All the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially as you grow. It's going to get harder and harder.
100%.
Let's finish this way. You're a serial entrepreneur solving hair on fire problems.
Yes.
What would you say to that young person coming out of university or trade school, or they just... they have this entrepreneurial bug that was somehow planted in your DNA. What's the biggest piece of advice you would give them so they can have sustained success?
Just one? Can I do like multiple?
Sure, you can do whatever you want.
All right. I'd say the first thing is don't be afraid of failure. In fact, welcome failure.
So,
my favorite quote has been fail fast. If you're going to, whatever you want to do, whatever business it is, whatever theory, like even when I was building a sales team, I said, is this the right way to build a sales team? I don't know. I never did it before. And so I wrote a hypothesis and I said, let's fail fast. Let's see how fast I can fail this hypothesis. And honestly, 2 months later, we had a fantastic sales team built and it's been working. It's been working amazingly, actually. And fail fast. Don't let that discourage you from that entrepreneurial bug. Just do it. Follow your dream. It will happen. But learn from those failures. And one of the biggest things I'd say that I think it took me time, especially like my early 20s, when you have a lot of energy, you're ready to jump, you're not afraid of risk.
You can change the world.
Right? Don't force it.
Oh, okay.
Take your time, do your research, make sure that you're solving a hair on fire problem. Make sure that this is a problem that's big enough, that there's a lot of people that have this problem. Take your time. It will happen. But trying to rush, Rome wasn't built in a day. Don't rush it. It will take time. And when you look back at things, you'll be like, oh my God, that went so fast. I thought scaling the company, we wouldn't get to it until a couple of years from now. And now I'm at a point where I'm hiring non-engineering, non-sales folks, right. And I couldn't have expected that. Yeah, so take your time.
Thank you so much, Mohammed. Just a fantastic story. I love your spirit. I love your energy. I wish you the best success. Let's stay connected over the course of your career.
Absolutely.
Pleasure to have you on the show, brother.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for today's episode of The Leader's Edge. Thank you for joining us. I hope today's conversation with Mohammed inspired you to lead with even greater purpose and passion. Here are my three big takeaways from my conversation with Mohammed. Number one, I love this. He said it this way, failure is a friend. He shared how his former business failures taught him how to be a business success. That's such a great mindset. It reminds me of one of my favorite new quotes. The master has failed more times than the beginner has tried. We must fail at some things if we're ever going to get really good at them. Number two, I love this. He said this again and again and again. Don't present nice-to-have solutions or solutions to nice-to-have ideas. Present gotta-have solutions. Find solutions for the problems that have people's hair on fire. Those are the solutions people are going to pay for. In economic uncertainty, people are not going to pay for nice-to-have solutions, but they will pay for gotta-have solutions. And number three, it sounds cliche, but he said, and I agree, follow your dreams. Don't give up on pursuing that big, crazy dream. That's what's propelled me. He said, let those things compel you and propel you, and I agree. Listen, if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I'd love a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. That feedback helps us reach more leaders just like you. And that's the point of this podcast, to reach leaders, inspire, sharpen, hone talent that's coming behind us, giving back, paying it forward. Stay connected with us on social media for behind-the-scenes content, leadership insights, and updates on future episodes. Check us out at yourleadersedge.com and follow us at Leaders Edge Podcast on all major platforms. So until next time, keep pushing your boundaries. Keep honing your edge. I'm HR Huntsman, and I'll see you soon.